Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. When we consider the climate of California in the West, we think of a Mediterranean climate for much of the Golden State, with Northern California into the Pacific Northwest cooler and wetter. But how long has the climate actually been like that? Turns out it's only been a few thousand years, and before that, the climate was very different. A new study from UC Davis researchers has brought together a myriad of Western U.S. climate studies over the years to provide a holistic picture of how climate has changed during the Holocene, the geologic epoch that stretches from now back 11,700 years. Our guests are two researchers who were key contributors to the study. Hannah Palmer was the lead author of the paper titled Holocene Climate and Oceanography of the Coastal Western United States and California Current System, which was published in the European Geosciences Union's Climate of the Past Journal. Joining Palmer is one of her collaborators, Veronica Vriesman, a marine scientist and paleontologist who is now at Oberlin College in Ohio. They join us now to talk about the study. Hannah and Veronica, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Hannah, you have a really cool title. Give us the full title, because I really like that.
My current position is as an American Association for the Advancement of Science and Geological Society of America Congressional Science Fellow.
And before we go any further, how does one become a Congressional Science Fellow, and what exactly does that mean?
It's a really amazing opportunity for people who have a doctoral degree in some STEM field to engage in working across this science policy divide. It's open to all folks who have a PhD in some STEM field and then get the opportunity to come to Washington, D.C. and really dive in the deep end working in policy.
Ah, and how long have you had that?
I've been in this role since the fall.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. And how about you, Veronica? How long have you been at Oberlin College?
I have also been at Oberlin since the fall. So Hannah and I happened to start our positions at pretty much exactly the same time.
And of course, you're both authors, and Hannah, you're the lead author on a really interesting paper that crossed my desk on my screen called Holocene Climate and Oceanography of the Coastal Western United States and California Current System. And I found this to be a fascinating study. What I'd like to do first, though, is ask, what was the genesis of this? How did this come about?
A lot of the work that I've done in the past was focused on understanding how climate had changed in the past and how that can best help us understand current climate change. And a lot of the work that I and Veronica as well have done was on the coastal Western United States and in the California Current System. And as we were both working on individual studies and projects in specific geographic locations, I kept looking for a paper like this. I kept looking for a place that we could look to, and it would give this big picture system looked like over the past about 11,000 years. And I could never find it. So I decided to write it. And in doing so, we got together and decided with Tessa Hill, who's also a author on the paper, to have a graduate level course on this topic. And so to start, we had a graduate level class with a cohort of students from really different backgrounds within environmental and geological sciences, asking this question of what this area looked like over the last 10,000 years. And then this cohort of us went on to write the paper to tell this broader story.
Okay, let's get to this paper, because this really was interesting to me. Let's start out by talking about the Holocene itself, because maybe a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with the geological timescale. Tell us about the Holocene. What period of time are we talking about here?
So the Holocene is the most recent geologic interval. Earth's 4.6 billion years of history is divided up into different intervals across a variety of scales. So the Holocene is actually an epoch, which is the smallest or most specific range of time. And the Holocene is the past 11,700 years. So coming out of a glacial stage, we call it an interglacial stage. There are no major ice sheets covering any of the continents for the most part. And it's really the interval over which human and environment interactions have intensified.
And I think a lot of us have the feeling that the climate has been relatively stable during this period of time until, you know, recent industrialization. But your paper does find that there's been quite an interesting bit of variability in the Western United States. So let's first start out by talking about what do we mean by Western United States for this study. Hannah, what's the geographic range here from north to south and east to west?
The study covers most of Washington, Oregon, and California, and really is focused on this coastal area. It includes some of British Columbia as well. And it includes the area, if you think about, bounded by the Sierra Nevada mountains are included, and some of the interior mountains in Washington and Oregon. But really thinking about this coastal area, it also includes the California Current System, which is the oceanographic system adjacent to the west coast of the United States. And the California Current is much broader than that. But really here we focused on this area from basically Southern California up to British Columbia in both the terrestrial and ocean spaces.
Can you characterize the California Current for us currently? What is it exactly like? Tell us about the California Current, because it's very interesting and it does have a dramatic impact on our climate here on the West Coast.
Yes, the California Current travels southward. You can picture it coming from Alaska down the coast of Canada and along the Western United States. And it brings cold, nutrient-dense water. And it's really important for the coastal systems we know today. It's also why if you go swimming in California, it's much colder than if you drew a straight line across the United States and went swimming on the eastern coast. Here on the west coast, the water is largely coming from the north. So you can picture that it was recently up in the Arctic near Alaska and is traveling down. A couple other important features is that off the coast of Southern California, there is an eddy. So we have a sort of a circular ocean current that happens off the coast of Southern California that makes the water a bit warmer. But otherwise, this current system is really important. And one other feature that I would like to talk about the California Current is that an important feature is wind-driven upwelling, which is the process of deeper waters coming up to the surface as winds blow surface waters away from the coast. And this is important because it brings even more cold, nutrient-dense water to the surface and sparks a lot of the life we see on the California coast.
Yeah, that current and that upwelling is why we have such a rich environment, marine environment of all kinds of interesting animal and plant life in the ocean. And I noticed also something, Veronica, I'd like you to ask you about. You're particularly interested in mussels, aren't you?
Yeah, that's correct.
Why is that? Tell us a bit about why mussels are special.
Wow, I could go on for a long time. But just to give you the basics, mussels are edible. They've been harvested by indigenous communities for more than 10,000 years and have provided a critical food source throughout the Holocene. And we still eat mussels today, obviously. But they also are what's known as foundation organisms in their environment. They provide a literal physical structure or substrate, 300 other species to live among and on.
Okay, let's talk about how the climate has changed during the Holocene, because it's very interesting to note one of the things I learned from reading your paper, like kind of was aware of, but not really, is how kind of the climatic regime has flipped a bit. So let's go back to the early Holocene. What would that be like, 11, 12,000 years ago?
Yes.
How was the climate like in the Pacific Northwest compared to the Southwest then?
In the early Holocene, the Pacific Northwest was warm and dry, not like what we think of the Pacific Northwest to be today. And in the Southwest was warm and wet. So we picture it warm today, but it was wetter at that time, which may have been related to two important factors. Monsoon events being more shifted to this region, and also potentially more atmospheric river-like storms, like some of those that the West Coast has been seeing recently.
And then during the middle Holocene, which is like 8,000 to 4,000 years ago, what was it like then?
In the middle Holocene, the Pacific Northwest was wet and cool, while the Southwest was dry and warm.
And in the more recent period, the late Holocene, about 4,000 years ago, how would you characterize that as being any different from the middle?
In the late Holocene, we see a wet Pacific Northwest, and sea surface temperatures were warm, and we start to see more of that upwelling that we already talked about becoming a dominant feature of the oceanographic conditions. In the Southwest, we see it is wet and variable relative to the early and middle Holocene. But something that's really important that came out in our study about the late Holocene, about this last 4,000 years, was an increase in variability, both between the records we looked at and within the records. So that means that sometimes places that were close to each other looked different from one another, or even within a single record of the last 4,000 years, we saw lots of variability.
So it's been a very dynamic and changing climate, you know, no matter what we might think about being relatively stable, you know, keyword relatively. It's interesting to note all of the changes that have gone on. I'd like to find out, you mentioned earlier that you were looking for this study and you couldn't really find the overarching study that you were looking for, so you decided to do it yourselves. Where did you get all of your data from? Where did you amass all of this from? Were they from mostly previous studies?
Yes. So importantly, this study rests on the shoulders of many other excellent scientists who have done great work before us. And the way we did the study was to bring together many other previously published studies. And importantly, most of them look at one place over a long period of time, or maybe one sub-region. And what we wanted to do is bring each of those pieces together to paint this bigger picture.
And how many places, because I was looking at a map on your paper, there's a lot of dots and a lot of numbers. How many places really are represented in this overall?
So there's two parts of the way that we did this work. The first part is that we went in and looked at each study, and we looked at each of these intervals we talked about, the early, middle, and late. And if the authors of the study had given an indication if it was wet or dry, warm or cool, or high or low fire activity, we put this into this coded analysis, which you can see in the maps in the paper. And for that work, we ended up using 75 different sites from 46 papers. And then we even went beyond that to include more papers in our overall analysis of the ecosystem impacts of these changes that we documented.
And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to be wondering, well, how do they know, you know, what the climate was like then in these specific areas? So let's dive into that a bit, because you have a huge array of paleoenvironmental signatures that you're looking at, if you will. Could you kind of just go through some of these, like from lake deposits to marine deposits? Tell us a bit about all the different ways that have been sampled through all of these studies that you mentioned, that we understand what's happened to our climate in the past.
It's such a great question, because I think it's such an interesting and fascinating thing to talk about. And it's part of why I've been interested in paleoclimate research. I think the first one I'll start with is tree rings. Many of us have maybe been to a place where we've seen a slice of a tree trunk and looked at the cross section of those rings through time. And you can maybe have even seen one where someone has taken note of how old that tree is or what each band represents. And tree rings are one of these really interesting archives that hold a history of the paleoclimate and paleoenvironment. So for tree rings, each banding represents an annual growth year. And so you can tell things, for example, in tree rings, how wide those rings are, or looking at the chemistry of the bark there, what the environment was like, how much rain there was, how warm or dry it was at that time. And just like tree rings, there's lots of other things that grow in these incremental ways, or that accumulate in incremental ways, that we can use as these records and archives of past climate. Another one that we used in this study is sediment cores. We did use sediment cores. Sediment cores were used for both marine and lake systems. So if you picture going out on a ship, on a boat, and taking a long pipe, putting it into the water and down into the sediments below, and pulling that up, you can then look at those sediment layers, layer by layer, going back in time. And this is really a record of what has settled into the lake or into the marine system. So there you'll have shells of small organisms that may have lived there, organic matter, meaning plants and things that fell into the water and died and settled at the bottom. And we can look at both what's there in terms of the shells and the different organisms, as well as the chemistry of the things that are there to give us information about past climate. I'll just add a couple more fun ones, and then I'll also let Veronica's answer as well. But a couple more fun things to add. A couple of the papers we looked at were lichenometry, including those that look at lichen history, as lichens can be very long-lived, and see where those are and how they've grown. Looking at shell archives. So we talked about mussels earlier. Each shell band can be like a tree ring recorder, as well as fire scars on things like trees and down stumps. There's really lots of interesting ways to read the stories of the past.
Yeah, and when you look at like charcoal deposits, you know, that are recorded in sediment layers, you can also use those to actually date these things, can't you?
Yes. Charcoal is one of the ways that we can date them. We can also use other things like shells of organisms like foraminifera or other plankton that are in marine systems that settle to the bottom. We can use those to age the systems as well.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the climate of the Western U.S. in the past with UC Davis climate scientist Hannah Palmer and Veronica Vriesman, a paleontologist and marine scientist at Oberlin College. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with climate and environmental scientist Hannah Palmer from the University of California at Davis and Veronica Vriesman, a paleontologist and marine scientist at Oberlin College in Ohio. And we're talking about Western U.S. climate in the past.
So marine organisms ranging from plankton to, you know, macro organisms can build shells out of the seawater around them. So they build calcium carbonate shells, or when they're really tiny, we call them tests. So foraminifera are a form of plankton that build these tiny shells, these tests. So when enough of them settle in enough sedimentary layers over time, and we take those sediment cores like Hannah was just describing, we can look through the layers, count the different types of forams, look at the different species of forams, and analyze their chemistry to see what the conditions of the water was like at the time that they formed their calcium carbonate test.
And then what about your favorites, mussels?
So mussels are similar in that they also form calcium carbonate shells, but they live in a totally different environment and they live for a much longer time. So while forams may be floating around for days to maybe a month, mussels can live decades to possibly even a century. We're not exactly sure. So you get a much different record or archive of time. And the way that they're growing is obviously at a different rate. So you get also a different resolution of time being recorded in those mussel shell bands.
And one of the really interesting things about when you consider the Holocene is that human beings have been here in the Western United States during this entire time, the indigenous people that lived here, and they have their own regime of how they managed fire and used it as a tool. You also, I believe I read somewhere that you also found sites in the Channel Islands in Southern California where you could actually kind of note the amount of shells there that the indigenous people, the Chumash, I believe they were, would be down there were collecting on the islands. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So the Channel Islands is one of the best places to look at archaeological shell records because it was so heavily settled for about the past 8 to 10,000 years. And also just because of the of the Channel Islands and the environment there, it's really suitable for excellent preservation. So not only was it a populous and dense site for human history and human settlement, but we also just have really good preservation of shells that are, you know, 9,000, 8,000 years old from these sites.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting when you think about it, because it's a national park and really kind of, you know, it's not populated now at all, you know, very, very limited population there. That's why it's so well preserved, because there's not, you know, when you think about just off the coast from Los Angeles, a heavily urbanized area where it's more difficult to find those artifacts, you have these pristine islands where you can find all this stuff. It's absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, exactly. And in addition to that, the soil pH and the kind of dry regime out there is really excellent for preserving the calcium carbonate shells that get deposited in the middens.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about fire, because it's always an important part of thinking about climate, and it dominates our thoughts here in California the last few years. What kinds of evidence did you find, you know, to kind of track the regimes of fire through the Holocene? Can you give us kind of an overview of what fire activity has been like over this period of time, these last, you know, 12,000 years?
Fire is such an important part of the landscape today, and it has been in the past in this region. You asked about evidence. So the way that most records we identify past fire history is, like you mentioned, in lake sediments, where we actually have charcoal, pieces of burned material that, you know, maybe a forest burns and a creek, some of that burned material runs off in a creek, ends in a lake. And we can use those charcoal deposits to identify the frequency of fires, how often they were, how often they came back to a system, and how big those fires were, lots of interesting pieces of the fire history. So overall in the region, we see that fire activity evolved across this time. In the early Holocene, fire activity was linked more closely to vegetation. So in the Northwest, we saw high fire activity in the early Holocene, and in the Sierra Nevada and Southern California, lower fire activity in the early Holocene. And this is because the forests didn't yet look like the way we know them to be today in those regions in Sierra Nevada and Southern California. As we move into the middle Holocene, we see that there's a more variable fire regime. And as the Sierra Nevada and Southwest become hotter and drier, we see an increase in fire activity, so high fire activity in that region. And in the late Holocene, we see high and variable fire activity in all regions.
And then, of course, in the very recent period of time, the last couple of hundred years, you have colonization, and that, you know, brings with it fire suppression, which has led to all kinds of catastrophic results of, you know, not allowing the forests to burn the way they had naturally or were burned by the indigenous people to manage them. That's interesting, too, to note the differences there. Any kind of interesting takeaways from your study from that?
Absolutely. It's important to note both the history of fire and that fire has been present in this region across this entire interval. And it's been an important driver of what ecosystems look like. And as you mentioned, humans have been interacting with fire in this region across the entire Holocene that we studied. And what's really important, and I think an important perspective that the paper brings, is that we intentionally sought out to look for the types of archives and records that gave us long time periods to look at. So those that covered a full interval, about a couple thousand years. And even within some of those types of records, like lake sediment cores and tree ring evidence, we can see this impact of modern colonial and fire suppression practices. We can see the change in fire activity following settler colonization and the large increase in fire around times that we think of as the gold rush. And we see a decrease in fire at the time of fire suppression. And then, as we know well today, for those people in the West, a huge increase in fire in the last several decades.
Yeah, indeed. And let's talk about some of the interesting mechanisms that are forcing or changing the climate, causing these climatic variabilities. What are some of the primary climate forcing mechanisms that you could kind of describe and list for us?
There are multiple factors that interact to drive climate change through the Holocene. One of those is orbital forcing, which is the tilt and the way the Earth spins around the sun changes very slightly over time. And as a result, in the early Holocene, we had a peak in Northern Hemisphere summer insolation, meaning there was lots of sun coming to the Northern Hemisphere in the early Holocene. And that's part of what contributes to being a warm time period. Additionally, ice sheets were melting at this time. We had just been coming out of the glacial time frame. Ice sheets melting leads to a lot of important feedbacks in the climate. Additionally, we have things that we talk about a lot today, actually, annual to decadal phenomenon like El Nino Southern Oscillation or ENSO that we often hear about, El Nino and La Nina, or also the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is a process that we see in the North Pacific being an important factor today. In addition to all of those, one of the important things that we identified in the paper was the interactions between marine and terrestrial systems and how these systems are linked and interact with each other.
Let's get into that, because that's really interesting to me, is how the ocean and the land, the terrestrial and the oceanic, are so linked. Tell us about some of those linkages and give us a little more detail on that. I'd like to know more about that.
In the Pacific Northwest, broadly, marine temperatures are linked with precipitation. When we have warm sea ocean temperatures, this is typically consistent with warm and dry inland conditions. And that's what we see in the early Holocene. In the middle Holocene, we see the opposite. We see cool sea surface temperatures and a wet hydroclimate. And then it's interesting as we move into the late Holocene, we see, in addition, another interacting factor is the factor of upwelling. We talked about this a little bit already, but I think if you're a person who lives in the West, you can know what this feels like. You know the feeling of a windy day with lots of fog. And the increase in upwelling over time has also been linked to an increase in coastal fog and the moisture that we know very well in Northern California and the Pacific Northwest. So in the late Holocene, we see enhanced upwelling, yet overall warm sea surface temperatures that both play a role in influencing what we know of the rain and hydroclimate in the Pacific Northwest. In the Southwest, we see that generally, marine temperatures are also correlated with precipitation. We see warm intervals linked with wet intervals, and periods of drought are often linked with cool sea surface temperatures. But in this region, in addition to what we see just with the coast right next door to the Southern California, we also know that there are important things like teleconnections, meaning things that are coming from further afield that also play an important role.
Veronica, is there anything you want to add to that about the ocean-terrestrial interaction?
Yeah, I'll just add that my favorite connection between the marine and the terrestrial realms is probably coastal redwoods. So the coastal marine fog layer that, if you've been to Northern California, you're familiar with, is what really sustains the coastal redwoods in Northern California. So I think that's a really nice example of the marine realm supporting a terrestrial ecosystem.
It's also fascinating for, you know, somebody that lives in Northern California, and I've lived here most of my life, that, you know, inland where I live, it can be very chilly in the wintertime and very, very hot in the summer. But yet when you go over to the coast, the Northern California coast, you kind of stay in that sweet spot of temperatures where it's, you know, it's never really actually cold, although it might feel chilly. It just kind of stays pretty much the same, right around 55 degrees or so. It's a fascinating way that the ocean controls the climate there.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk a bit more about the methodology that you're using here, because I do find it fascinating. When you look at all of the papers that you've gone through, and people, I'm sure, ask you things about climate change all the time. They want to know, like, well, you know, hasn't the climate always changed, and that sort of thing? Or they look at this year with a very cold, wet winter and think, well, gosh, how can the planet be warming when, you know, it's so cold and wet and there's so much snow in the Sierra? Do you get asked questions like that very often? And how do you counter them?
Absolutely. I think this is a really common question, and a way that paleoclimate can be really informative. Yes, the climate has changed in the past, absolutely. But the climate change that we're seeing currently due to human-caused forcings is different in several important ways than the climate change that we recorded and talked about in this study. One of the really important things that is different is the rate of change and how fast things are changing. The scales that we're talking about in the paper that we wrote, we're talking about change on a millennial scale, things happening over a couple thousand years, and those broader general transitions. And change we're talking about today is on much, much faster time scales. You know, within a year or a decade, we're seeing huge shifts. And I think that's one way that, while this is a common question to ask, hasn't it always changed in the past? It actually can be one of the best ways to understand modern change, that although the system has changed in the past, the fingerprint we are currently putting on the system is a bigger, faster push than what we've seen in this region over the last 11,000 years.
Veronica, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll also add that anthropogenic climate change, human-induced climate change, doesn't just mean that everything is all getting warmer all at the same time and at the same rate. It means that variability is going to increase. Extreme events are going to increase. So when we see storms or a cold snap, all of this is part of a climate transition that we have really strong evidence as being connected to human activity, particularly since 1850.
And when you go back to when you were at UC Davis, and you believe you were at the UC Davis Bodega Marine Lab, right? Is that where this kind of all started?
Yes, I spent a lot of my time there, and Veronica spent some time there as well. We were very fortunate to have that coastal experience as part of our experience. And as you said, to experience the climate of both the coast as well as the inland climate at Davis, two very different parts of California.
Absolutely. And when you go back to think about yourselves back then, when you were first embarking on this, what were some of the things you thought then compared to now? Like, what are some of the big takeaways from this study for both of you? So I'll start with you, Veronica. What are some of the things that you're really taking away from this paper and the study that's gone on that really affected the way you think about it?
I think for me, the thing that surprised me or stood out to me right away is how the past 10,000 or so years have been. You mentioned this earlier, but we all think of things being the way they've always been, or the past several thousand years being relatively static. So when we started diving into this, I was struck by how much variability there's been across all of these sites across this region and the types of variability, right? It's not just warmer or cooler, it's hydroclimate, it's fire, and linkages between all of these things. And the next big takeaway for me is the connection between humans and the environment and the nature of our interaction with the environment and how that's changed over time. So we've gone from interaction and management and cultivation to suppression of ecosystems and controlling of ecosystems. And we're going to have to start paying closer attention to that as human-induced climate change ramps up.
Hannah?
I think Veronica said it very well. And I think that one piece that she mentioned is the importance that there are these changes over time. And secondly, the important piece of the changes of how humans have interacted with the environment in this region. And I'll also add that I think an important outcome of the paper is the way we are able to link together multiple systems and better understand how the marine systems interact with terrestrial systems, how the temperature and the hydroclimate interact with fire activity, and start to answer some of these questions about drivers. When we think about best predicting the future, it's important to know how systems already operate and how they change with, even without the push of human-induced climate change. And so understanding those drivers and connections is really important.
If you're just joining us, our guests are Hannah Palmer, a climate scientist at UC Davis, and Veronica Vriesman from Oberlin College. And we're talking about their recent study of Western U.S. climate during the Holocene epoch, which spans back in time nearly 12,000 years. Let's take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with UC Davis climate and environmental scientist Hannah Palmer and Veronica Vriesman, a paleontologist and marine scientist from Oberlin College. There's some really interesting dynamic situations going on with the climate during the Holocene in the Western United States. And I ran into a term I'd like you to explain to me in the significance of it, the Holocene conundrum. What is that?
It's a great term, the Holocene conundrum. This term comes from our work, scientific work broadly, trying to understand what this time frame looks like. And if we look at global temperature change over this time interval, we see that globally, there was warming and a warm interval from the beginning of the Holocene to about 5,000 years ago. But then scientific evidence in different regions of the world differs. Some regions show warming while others show cooling. And this is this concept called the Holocene conundrum, this divergence of where we see regional change. And so for us, that was an important question to ask of what did that time interval look like here in this place?
And along the same lines, what there are a couple of interesting parts that go along with this, I think. The medieval climate anomaly, what was that?
Yeah, the medieval climate anomaly is an event that we see in kind of the medieval era, right? So the European medieval interval. We identify, or actually many people before us have identified across a variety of records as an unexpectedly warm period linked to drought conditions throughout the study region here. And then along with that, I always like to define the Little Ice Age. And that was an interval of cooling identified across the Northern Hemisphere. So these two events, the medieval climate anomaly and the Little Ice Age, are smaller events that kind of pop up across a range of records in this interval.
And another interesting mechanism, if you will, to think about is volcanism, because the Pacific Northwest is a very volcanic region with the Cascade volcanoes that extend down into Northern California here with Lassen Peak and Mount Shasta. Did you find any interesting evidence from volcanic deposits in your studies?
Broadly, I would say that we didn't find anything that was really showing major climate impacts due to volcanic activity at this time in the region we studied. But one of the ways volcanic activity does play a role here is that it's really helpful in determining ages of a lot of the records that we looked at. So when we're looking at things like sediment cores, we can see volcanic deposits coming in as well at these really distinct different layers showing up in the archives.
So you can use those as time signatures?
Yes.
And are we talking about ash deposits or actual lava?
We can see both.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Okay. And as you look at the big picture here, is there any practical use for like land use planning in the future and things takeaways from your paper that you're hoping people might, you know, look at this and say, aha, you know, these are some things maybe we can use to plan things differently. For example, you know, when we started to colonize the West and California in particular, Southern California, it happened to be during a relatively wet period, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'll say that along with colonization comes land use change, right? So mission agriculture and ranching started popping up in Southern California in the 1850s. And this impacted the marine environment, interestingly enough, because as you mentioned, we have increased rainfall and all of that agricultural runoff gets carried out into the shallow marine environment and drastically changes marine communities living off the coast. So this is just kind of one example. There are many of these of human activity driving a completely different ecosystem from the immediate ecosystem or immediate environment being affected. So we can kind of use these as case studies to help inform ongoing and future land use changes and planning.
I'm curious, what's been the reaction to your paper in the scientific community for climate scientists and paleoclimate experts? What's been some of the reaction you've been getting to this paper?
I would say a first reaction is thank you. Thank you for putting these pieces together would be something that I have heard when, especially in the process when we were putting this together and we were reaching out and talking to other scientists, going to conferences and having conversations about the work that we were doing. And that there really is a need to understand this bigger picture. One way I like to think of this paper is that if you've seen the type of art where there's many individual images or pieces of art that make up one broader image, maybe it's a bunch of small images of trees that make one larger image of a tree. I like to think of our paper in that way, and that it couldn't exist without all of these really important studies that other scientists have done in the past. And what we did was put them together to create this big picture of what the whole interval looked like.
Veronica?
Yeah, this region is widely studied. A lot of people live here and a lot of people research the Western U.S. and certainly the coastal regions. So the reason that we were able to do this study at all is because so many people came before us and chose a site, analyzed an archive, and wrote their own paper on climate change using a particular record at one site. And so we were able to stitch all of these together to come up with broader patterns for this region that so many people live in and depend on and have for a very long time.
And of course, if you look at what California and the West have been like, well, California in particular, in the last 10 years, we've gone through this terrible cycle of drought, punctuated with periods of deluge, where we get, you know, incredible amounts of precipitation, and this year being, you know, a prime example of that. Do you see any evidence of those kinds of events in the past in your studies?
There are certainly intervals of drought and of heavy precipitation in the times that we studied. There has been significant other work that's looked at this, particularly in the Southwest, and looked at the last several thousand years, looking at intervals of drought. And we have seen this happen before. We know that this region has can be quite dry. I think that what you mentioned is the really important part of modern climate change, is what some people are calling the climate whiplash, where we see back-to-back extremes, intervals of drought punctuated with these intervals of deluge. And that's something that we don't see as much of in the past records that we were looking at, and especially at the scale we were looking.
Well, it's been great to talk to you two about this incredible study. It was very interesting to read, and I hope you keep doing great work. So thanks for joining us. We really appreciate you being here, Veronica Vriesman and Hannah Palmer, about this great UC Davis study on the climate of the Western United States in the past 12,000 years.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the time to be here and so happy to share the results of this work with your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to our guests, Hannah Palmer, climate and environmental scientist at UC Davis, and Veronica Vriesman, a paleontologist and marine scientist at Oberlin College. And now's the time on the show when, from time to time, we have Matt Fidler, our producer extraordinaire, ask a question, a segment we call the Teachable Moment. And this one's kind of special. This is Teachable Moment about the stars by the seasons, and we're going to do the stars of spring. So welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, it is spring now, and I know you're going to tell us about some stuff, you know, what we could see in the sky this time of year, but let's just start from the real basics. Why do we see different stars each season?
Well, that's a really good question, and one of those things that sounds so basic, but it's important to understand. If you are looking to the southern part of the sky, which is basically not looking due north, you will see different stars during different seasons, the seasonal constellations, as we call them. And to understand how this works, you could just do a really simple thought experiment, or you can go outside and do it yourself, or maybe take your kids out and teach them that way. It'd be fun. Walk in a circle around a tree or a tree stump or something like that. It could be a fire hydrant, anything. That thing represents the sun. And so when you walk in a circle around it, start at one point, say like 12 o'clock, and face away from the object, from the sun, and you're looking in that direction, whichever direction that is. Now make a quarter of the way around the circle, and again, face away from the sun. Now you're looking in a different direction. You know, just you're looking basically 90 degrees from the direction you were looking before. Now go to halfway around the circle and you're looking 180 degrees away because, you're facing away from the sun. You're looking in the opposite direction of where you were looking at the beginning. Now another quarter trip around and you're looking in another direction again, 180 degrees from your first stop after you started. So each time you go those quarters, you're looking in a different direction. The Earth is doing the same thing when it goes around the sun. So each season, you know, because there's four seasons, represents those quarter turns around the circle. You're looking in a different direction out into space. And so we see different sets of stars, the seasonal constellations.
Well, that makes sense. And what about the Big Dipper? Because I feel like I can always find that in the sky, no matter what season it is.
Yeah, the stars in the northern part of the sky, they're called circumpolar because they circle around the pole star, Polaris, every 24 hours. So basically half of that turn each at night. And Polaris is very close to directly over the Earth's North Pole. It's always in the same place year round. It's easy to find if you know the Big Dipper.
Okay. So now where is the Big Dipper then now in spring?
If you face due north and look up and to the right, northeast, that's where it is. It's like standing on the end of the Dipper handle. So the big spoon part facing the pole star. And you can use the two edge stars of the spoon. They're called the pointers and they point right at Polaris. And it's just kind of fun to learn. That's how you can find Polaris. It's not that bright a star.
Okay.
Did you know, Matt, that the Big Dipper is not a constellation?
Really? So, okay, if it's not a constellation, what is it? I feel like it's the first constellation I learned, but I guess it's not a constellation.
Yeah, for a lot of people, it is. It's in the constellation Ursa Major, the Great Bear, but it's called an asterism or a star pattern. We're really good at making patterns out of things. So, you know, there are a lot of objects in the sky, asterisms that, you know, we can make patterns out of, like squares and things like that. And the Big Dipper is an asterism. It looks like a big giant ladle. People have been seeing it that way for millennia. One of my favorites in spring, another asterism, you know, star pattern, is the sickle of Leo the Lion. It looks just like a backwards question mark, and it rises up in the spring, very prominent in the spring sky when you're looking south. It's one of those seasonal constellations that lets you know it's spring at night, and it looks like a backwards question mark. Once you see it, you just never forget. It's really easy to identify.
Very cool. Okay, so what other cool things should we be looking for in the spring sky right now?
Wow, there's just too many things to cover here, but one really interesting, neat thing is that you'll notice that you don't see the Milky Way. So if you're in a dark sky spot, you're not anywhere near town lights, you know, most times of the year you can look up and there's the Milky Way stretching across the sky. That's how you know you've got a dark sky and no moon out. You can see the Milky Way. But in the spring, we don't see the Milky Way. This is the time, again, we're looking at a different direction out into space, where in the winter months, we were looking towards our local spiral arm of the galaxy of the Milky Way. That's where you see Orion and Gemini and those stars. And the winter Milky Way is very beautiful. Well, in the spring, we're looking out of the galaxy. So what we see, if you have like a really nice pair of binoculars and a dark sky or a small telescope, you're looking at what's called the realm of the galaxies. There are clusters of them. They look like little teeny smudges, like little teeny cloud smudges. And those are all sovereign galaxies, hundreds of billions of stars, other Milky Ways, and there's just lots of them in the spring sky. So spring is kind of the season of the galaxies. Very, very cool, each one, again, containing hundreds of billions of stars. And as Carl Sagan liked to say, the realm of the galaxies is nature on the grandest scale.
Indeed. Well, thank you for this, Dave. Can we do another one of these come summer?
Sure. Yeah, we can do one every season. And but go out and enjoy the stars of spring. And even if you don't have binoculars or a telescope, you can still just look at that kind of empty of the Milky Way part of the sky and realizing you're looking out at there are many, many galaxies out there, more than you could count. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.